Today is September 21st, 2017. I am Mary Manning with the University of Houston, and I'm working on a research project called Community Practice, Identity Building in Gulf Coast Sound. I am at my home with Nick Gaitan, who is a bass player, guitar player, singer-songwriter, and he's kindly agreed to share his knowledge and experience about performing in bands as well as DJing. So the first we'll talk maybe more about being in the band, but if you think about something DJing that applies, you can then, and yeah. We'll probably save more of the stuff about DJing towards the end.
Gotcha.
Describe the musical genres you perform.
Everything I perform ranges from, it depends on the band I'm playing with, but everything goes, I like to say, it comes from all roots music, from blues, from Tejano, from Conjunto. There's also my Mexican roots music that is influenced in there. I'm influenced by, well, I guess when it comes to stuff that I play, it's blues, Tejano, country, and soul-based. But then the other influences feed in from things that I listen to but don't necessarily play. For example, mariachi music, rancheras, things like that. But they find their way into the forms, I think, you know.
Describe how the different genres you perform combine with or influence each other, if they do.
Okay. Well, I think whenever you're doing something like soul music, or you're doing something like, say, some sort of, you know, a Gulf Coast soul or blues-based music, like Swamp Pop, for example, mixes with some of the songs. There's some songs in Spanish, some Mexican songs that actually sound like that could be easily translated into Swamp Pop. Just like it happens in Zydeco, some R&B songs can be turned into a Zydeco song and vice versa. And in the end, one of the main ingredients of Zydeco is R&B. But that's kind of the way genres already have snuck, you know, merged. They've become hybrids just because that's the way jazz was created in the first place. There was some, you know, music is, there's always a place for other type of musics to mix with each other, other genres to mix with each other. It kind of just happens. And the more that, I believe, the more types of music that you're familiar with, that you actually feel and identify with, you can mix those. I mean, that's what so many genres have been sort of created based on that.
Talk about, or tell me more about maybe some of the genres, the more historical genres that are based on mixing.
That are based on?
Mixing genres, you know.
Oh, okay. For example, you know, something like Zydeco, that's a heavy influence to lots of musicians on the Gulf Coast, all over, but really down here it's where it comes from. I think that's a mix of, you know, there's clearly a mix of R&B and the early Lala music, the early stuff from the old Creole tunes. I mean, lots of Cajun music mixed in there. That's one of those things. Those two just, you know, merged together and became one thing because people were feeding that influence in. Fast forward to bands like, on the other side of things, like Los Lobos, bands like that, where genres were created because they were influenced by rancheras, by rock and roll, by soul, by Tejano, by, you know, this is how I think it happens there. Stuff that I end up playing myself is mixed, you know, has all of those genres that I mentioned earlier mixed in together, because when I'm writing a song, unless you're picking out, I'm going to write a blues song, and you stick to that formula. I mean, sometimes I just let my songs write themselves as far as what the influence goes. What kind of song is it going to be? Well, I don't really know yet. I'm just going to write the music. And that would happen a lot. That's happened in all my bands where we're creating and it doesn't become one thing. That's kind of one of the things I learned early in Scarnales, because we would mix ska and rockabilly, which are to us they're connected. But those two musics, those two genres on their own would you know, they both have their own history, and they're both very different from two different places. But we found a way to connect them. So.
Describe how audience interaction influences what you play and how you play it.
The main thing that I think about when you ask me that question is when people are dancing. It's not a one-on-one, or it's not, the audience and the band are not, say, looking right at each other, getting that type of reaction from each other. But when a band is playing and you see people out there dancing, even if they're in their own world, that's the type of audience band interaction that I think I appreciate the most. Because as a musician, yeah, you want the audience to be captive. Sometimes that means having them stand there and, watch you do what you do. But something that really gets me is when people dance. And I think that's one of the most rewarding things, because, in the end of the day, if you're somebody, you're up there on stage, you want that feeling to reach everybody who's watching, and you want that feeling to fill the room. And some people just react differently to what you're sending out.
Describe the different venues that you play in locally, and maybe about how audience interaction may be different at different venues.
All right, so as a musician, for the last 18 years, I played everywhere from house parties, early days house parties with your friends when you're in that band in high school. And I've played in, clubs and bars around town. I've played in, bigger stages, where it was clearly, some sort of race park or some theater or some huge festival. Done all of those, and they're all different, so I think whenever you're playing like at your local, your dive bar that you hang out at, in your neighborhood, and you play there because you love to play there, that audience reaction is a big mix, because there's people checking you out in the perimeter, there's people sitting at different tables if there are tables, people standing in front of the band. So some people are looking at you, some people are watching, some people are, I guess, standing around like you would at a party, and there's just a band going down. There's just a set going on. There's the people that dance. That same environment, even in a small dive that holds maybe 50 people inside, that same thing transfers to, it applies to all the size venues. But sometimes you get into a sort of situation where you're playing at a theater, for example, and it's all seated audience. How do you turn those people on? All they can do is sit there and and look at you. They get up off their seats and dance. That's cool. So there's different situations, and I think they can all be appreciated, because you can tell when an audience is when an audience is engaged. It's clear the energy, the electricity is going. The difference to me is not of of course, if you're standing in front of a few thousand people, you're gonna have a different feeling than whenever you're in the bar of 50. But the energy and the love is just as big whenever they're into it. When the audience is engaged and digging what you do and they move to what you're doing, it doesn't really matter where you're at. The magnitude of that love comes through, and it's awesome. The heat in the room, those hot, hot summer nights you're playing in a bar, they're just as cool as when you're on that big old stage. But yeah, of course, the electricity, the love doesn't change, but I think the size of the audience, it affects you mentally in different situations. You get in a different mindset if you're playing in a theater or some quiet songwriting, you know, songwriter room where it's, you know, you can hear the crickets chirp, you can hear a pin drop, as they say, and then the bar where sometimes you're not the wallpaper, you're competing with the loud, because you're in a loud bar, you're hanging out, but they're there at a party, and you kind of have to engage with that, you know, with that too. So.
Tell me about, and this pertains to Umbrella Man.
Okay.
With Umbrella Man, is there a different, and if so, describe the differences between a local show and a show out of town.
So Umbrella Man, when we were doing that, and we had that set lineup of four musicians, we had, and the instrumentation was steel guitar, upright, accordion, and drums, and vocals, of course. Locally, we had played a lot and got our stage show to be a lot of country, conjunto, swamp pop. Was it swamp pop, Tex-Mex, cumbias, rock and roll, some rockabilly. We would mix all those genres that we like. And locally, that would always get, you know, that was always a cool thing, because we would do different gigs around here, from everything from, you know, the D&W Lounge, real small bar in Second Ward, to, you know, something downtown, say during the Super Bowl. So the gigs were, they had that whole dynamic of, I'm either doing something down here in the neighborhood, or I'm playing, you know, playing at a more international stage because of what's going on. Because the context changes, of course. There's been other times where, well, when we're not, those are all local. They're just all of different sizes. But then there's the times that, you know, say we played in Fullerton, California for Kid Ramos's birthday, or we did a PBS recording in Chicago on the main stage. And that ended up coming out on TV. And well, there was two PBS recordings. There was one in Chicago that was a live show, and there was another one in Houston for Skyline Sessions. But I guess that's different, because you don't have a studio audience, you don't have a stage audience. The only way that it was different for us was because, you know, the way it compares to each other. I mean, locally, you see all the familiar faces. You see the people who you know support you in your town. And, of course, the different a different nature of a different show, you're going to run into strangers. You play a festival, you're going to get a lot of new fans. So it's kind of, I want to say it's the same everywhere you go, but it's different everywhere you go. It's different in your own town. So every show is a sort of case by case type thing on you know, for that question. They're all different, they're all the same.
Could you make any generalizations about the differences between playing for the audience at the DNW versus playing for an audience at the Big Top?
Those two, they're pretty similar, because the Big Top is part of the whole Continental Club building and that whole block there. So there's always been a love for roots music there. I mean, the place, you know, I mean, where Little Joe Washington lived. I lived there for 10 years. I've seen that place from the day it was opened, from the year it was opened, when I was opening up shows for Flaco Jimenez when I was in Los Carnales, to when I had Umbrella Man, that band going on, we were opening up for different, you know, Southern Culture on the Skids, the Super Suckers, Flaco again, you know, then, you know, side, you know, what do they call them, spinoffs of my band, started by my other members, would open up for other bands there. So there was always that, we always had established our audience, friends and fans there. And since it's, you know, really, you know, distance-wise, it's not that far from here in the barrio. You know, you go to D&W, a lot of times those same people will frequent those same bars. The regulars, however, like different things. The regulars at the Continental like certain something. But if you spin off and you do certain tunes at the D&W, for example, then yeah, you'll get, it's just, it's again, it's, they're very similar. They love a lot of the same things. Sometimes this bar A will you know, freak out over these songs, and bar B will do that over another set of songs.
Tell me a little more about which type of song they may freak out at about.
Oh, yeah, yeah. DAW. Like specifically. Okay. Yeah.
The type. Yeah.
For example, we, cumbias were real big at the DNW. We had a lot of dancers that would dance to cumbias. And, you know, honestly, I think for this specific question, I think cumbias, swamp pop songs like Matilda, Wasted Days and Wasted Nights, things like that, people dance to those all the time. Cumbias would get the whole room going. Swamp pop type songs would get the couples going and would get the guys that were braving up to, you know, go ask the girl to dance. The Tex-Mex songs were for people who just get bouncing because they hear that polka beat. I guess for those three genres, let's say, that works in both clubs, you know, in both bars. And then again, like I said, the audience is generally the same. You have your regulars over here, your regulars over here, both, you know, at both bars. And then you have the ones that'll go, they don't, you know, they leave their neighborhood, they leave their regular bar and go see other bars. So it's really, when the band goes over here, they know that's the sound that this band is going to bring. So they kind of know the night that they're anticipating. I'm going to dance. When they play this song, I can't wait. This is our favorite song. Like, we have those types of things. The age difference makes a little bit, you know, makes some sort of impact. So sometimes I play the slower dance songs, like a Freddie Fender song or Matilda by Cookie and the Cupcakes. I'll play that one earlier at, say, a gig that I know that the older folks that are hanging out are going to be catching my first set. I'll play the things that they can dance for the ones that still dance. Our shows at, you know, so that, having said that, our shows start earlier when we're doing a neighborhood bar, especially when you have regulars that sometimes go up to the age of 80. I've seen them older. Like, I mean, there's some, you know, it's an easy bar to park at. It's a neighborhood bar and people have been going there for decades. So then the older clientele have their regular, you know, nights that they go out and, you know, drink a few beers. What we would do at the Big Top would be a little bit later, and our gigs weren't starting until about 10:30. So we had to go after the night was already spinning. It was already going hard. But then you have a bar that you have to park at one end of a place and walk. It was a little bit more to get to, so we had a younger audience, you know, that, and I think that had a big impact on it, because sometimes older folks are going to go where they're going to go, and they're going to, you know, they'd have their routine set in. So I think that's why we had our older audience early on. Then as the night progresses and gets, you know, gets later, then you have different crowds come in, different waves of people. When you're doing one of those bar nights where you're playing more than one set, because these aren't just, those two places, those two situations aren't like feature shows where you come out and you're doing a 40-minute set, 60-minute set, and then you get off. These are the things where these are the shows where you're entertaining the bar all night. Bar gigs. That's what they're called. That's how they work.
Describe any type of verbal feedback that you get from the audience members. Maybe after the show, do they ever talk to you about your music?
Yeah. There's all kinds of feedback. It could go from the person that wants to talk shop with you after the gig about music. It's about the person that says, I can't believe you know that song. That is so cool. Aren't you too young to know that song? Or, man, that's a real, like, you know, other times where people are like, man, that wasn't a very popular song from that band. That's cool that you do that. These things happen. And of course, then you start nerding out, you know, with somebody about how you know that. Well, I got into this band because of this and this. And, you know, especially your record collector friends or just your music lovers, music nerds in general. This was the B-side for this. So, man, I always wanted to sing that song. I know it wasn't very popular, but this is awesome that it's on this record, you know. And that could apply to any band, you know, because we like what we know is popular by, say, Hank Williams, you know, but there's some of those songs deep in there. I mean, of course, so many of his, all of his to me were great, but I'm like, there's those that are sort of on the outer edge of what everybody else sees, you know, and that happens with every artist, I think. I mean, B-sides in general, jazz songs that are not that common.
Would you describe any of the genres that you perform as less known currently?
I think I've been asked before, like most out of all the genres we do play, I think I've been asked before, what is swamp pop? But anybody from around here knows what it is because they've heard the term. But I think, I forgot the question.
Don't worry about it. How did you get into swamp pop?
Through records, through old records and old songs. I got into it just by kind of hearing it all my life, because it's one of those genres that sneaks into country, sneaks into, you know, Mexican music, sneaks in. It's everywhere, and it's just this sort of blues format. It's like if Fats Domino music being applied to any other genre around it, you know.
How does your band get gigs? I'm thinking more. I know you play in a few bands.
But the ones that
Umbrella Man.
Okay.
You're probably more involved with getting this.
Yeah, I do the booking for my bands or any sort of combo of musicians that I'll get the work for us. I get called a lot. I get called by different bars or promoters, or there's an event coming to town and I'm going to be a good fit. So I'll get a call, for example, from Heights Theater to open up this show because they found me to be... A lot of times bands come to town looking for local support. National bands come touring looking for local support. If you fit that type of show or that type of... whether it's demographic, audience, whatever the factor is, if you fit that show bill, then you're going to get a call, especially if you put your name out there. That's what I do. So I have music out. We get some... local radio play from KPFT, for example. That's our main source of any play on FM that we get. The rest is internet. The rest is internet promotion, social networking, word of mouth, and just events that we throw in the community with this scene of folks. And that's a whole other different thing that has all these channels, connections, and loops through it. But I get gigs because people either see me fit for a bill, but there's other times where they're creating an event and they want a certain vibe. And I'll get those gigs based on that. Can you come play a few sets? We're having, you know, our 1 year anniversary party for this barbershop that we have had open. It's been successful. Can you play our 1 year anniversary? It's the same way you get called for weddings. Somebody saw your band out at a bar. And they're like, I love these guys. I need them at my wedding. We've had that happen plenty of times. Weddings are one of our cooler things because they don't want us to do a bunch of, you know, wedding band stuff, you know. And we don't. So all we have to do is go in there and be ourselves. And that's really all we ever intended to be.
Tell me more about the scene of folks and the channels and the connections and the loops.
Yeah. There are people that you meet from your neighborhood that influence you in music or cars, or they do something, some sort of subculture that you find yourself in, whether you grow up and you're a skater or you're a guitar player or you're something. You match up with these smaller groups, just like any, you know, people do when they're kids. They find their group of weirdos or their group of friends or the group of people that outer circle outside your family, you know, that secondary sort of circle that you meet in life that is not your blood, but then they're the ones that you identify with. And you find that you're not only this one thing in this group, but you have these other friends that do this. Well, that happens whenever, that happened to me with being a music lover, say in high school, and meeting people that like the same music. So then that's how high school seemed for me. It was funny. That's why there were groups of people like the Kickers and the Punk Rockers and the Headbangers and the this and the Vaqueros and everybody else. And it was funny because the majority of what would sort of group these people together, this identity was based on music. Music being such a big part of lifestyle, it's people's like soundtrack of life. So there's that. You have these friends that like the same music as you. But then you have this other group of friends who does that other thing you do, whether it's play, you know, you're a skateboarder or you're a basketball player or you're a football. It could be sports. It could be any extracurricular activity. These are the people that do that. So I identify with this group. Well, then somehow these two groups, you know, they end up being connected, or somebody that you just met along the way. It's basically just a network that keeps expanding. So it happened with me, for example, in our scene of people. You have your musicians, you have your artists, and those two end up finding their way together really fast. I mean, I've seen it time and time again throughout my life with a beautiful scene that, you know, I get to be part of as a musician. I've met some of the best artists, and then, you know, we grow together, we dream together, we talk about stuff. The ones that, you know, the ones that you hang with, and, you know, you see them going through the same thing you're going through. They're doing their showings, you know, in galleries and stuff. They're doing these different parties. You're playing bars, you're playing parties, coming up. Everybody's coming up. And when the opportunity presents itself, or something ends up, this different occurrences that go on, you notice, there I am on this stage. How did we get here? And somehow your friend did the graphic arts or did the painting that's represented in the signs that's being used for the same event. That connects us. Then, part of entertainment, all your entertainers know each other. You know your DJs, you know your mariachi groups, you know your rock and rollers, you know your the ones that, you know, the other musicians. Everybody somehow finds their way to know each other. A lot of the creatives do. A lot of the fans do. Then there's those extra, you know, rings of friends outside of that. So it's this great glue that brings us together. But it usually, music is something that I've seen bring people together that way. That community is based around music we like. Then it turns into something else. Or our culture, our common culture that we either are or identify with. Because it's a mixed bag of people that come from all over too.
More about the networks within the music scene.
Okay.
Amongst musicians.
Okay. How do you mean more than just?
Do you help people get gigs, or, you know,
like that? Okay.
Or even connections across time.
Okay. So you play in several bands across, you know, over the span of 10, 15 years, you played in several bands. So you make different relationships with those musicians. They happen because you're in a band together, you travel together. Things like this happen. So you kind of look out for each other as you would any friend. And sometimes a job opportunity comes up. I'm a bassist primarily, and that's most of that's the instrument that's taken me all over the world now. And, you know, so that's what I identify myself as the most, as a bass player, because the results have been, that's what's taken me. And that's the only reason I say that. But if I'm out of town and I have this great gig in Houston that I just physically can't be at because I'm going to be somewhere else, there are different people through this, you know, through all this time of me playing music, playing bass. There's a list of people that have either, usually when they live in town, I can give them the gig because it's just more practical, right? I've had friends that have moved away where it's like, well, that was the person that I called, but then other people come up that, you know, other bassists, for example, that I know the guy I'm going to plug into. That's what, that like plug the give him the work, and then he plugs into my spot, and then you're given somebody the work you would have taken that you couldn't take. That's one way that we network. The other way we network is you have you're a musician and you have this friend that's opening up a gallery. Well, he needs some entertainment. And you sort of end up, it can be, unless there's, it depends if there's funding, the situations change. But if it's somebody just independent without a budget, you end up bartering something out of it. If it's people with sponsors, you end up, these networks can happen any kind of way. But there's a million ways to skin that cat.
There's kind of two ways to answer this question, I think. Mm-hmm. But it's, tell me about performers or acts you perform with. And I'm thinking about bands that you perform with or other performers that you mm-hmm. perform with.
Tell you about them. Tell you what about them.
Who they are.
Oh, okay. Okay. I could tell you all the people I've played with and things we did. Like, in the summer of 99, I joined Los Carnales, a Houston Mexican-American ska band led by Felipe Galvan. And this is a band I used to go watch in high school that I ended up being in. I would go to all their shows. I met a lot of friends there, established some of these networks that we talked about. Because you're just fans of music coming together, but you come from all walks of life. So when I joined this band, I meet seven people that I, it was probably seven or eight, that I didn't know before. So you meet all these, these talented guys you're about to go play shows with, and you get to know each other. And the more you travel, because at that point in 99, I hadn't been anywhere but the Alamo and maybe Austin, Texas for a basketball tournament in junior high. So first thing I did was travel with them to Sunken Gardens. And we ended up playing so many stages over the years. The International Accordion Festival, gigs in Monterrey, Mexico. I mean, Mexico City, Juarez. We did a U.S. tour. Did a lot of stuff with them. So a lot of that was just raw experience. Was that first band that I was in, Los Carnales. When I started my own band, by the time I left Los Carnales, I was starting The Umbrella Man. And that band, I had already known, had started knowing how to book shows, how to put shows together. I was doing my original writing. I had understood the nature of a show, so I was able to put those on together. So I went from a position of being new with my first band and going through all those years with that experience to where I ended up being the booking. I was booking the band. I was sort of managing it in my last years, the last several years, co-managing with Felipe. But I would do a lot of the booking there at the last years. And like I said, when I was taking off with my own band, I already had, the wheels had been greased and I knew what to do. So after starting booking my own band, then I was also getting sit-in gigs and that where I would go play bass for, say, a country band, for a rockabilly band. I would do a set with them. So I started knowing, started learning how to freelance myself, put myself out there and go be a freelance musician playing for everybody you had time to. This is going to get me closer to playing full time. At that time, I was playing with a band called Sean Reefer and the Resin Valley Boys. I would back up people like Max Stevens on the Continental stage. I would back up other bands that came through and needed a bass player. I started learning how to do that. I was like, this is cool. This is how you play with anybody and everybody. A few years past that, I got hired by Billy Joe Shaver, and playing with a songwriter of that magnitude was really life-changing, because I drove right up to his front yard. I mean, while I was given a ride. When he hired me, the story about when Billy Joe hired me started 6 months before it even happened, because there was a record label at the Rice Mansion on Hadley in Midtown that was owned by the Knowles family, Music World. and there was a sub-label of that called Compadre Records. There was a guy named Brad Turcotte that owned that label or ran that label, and he asked Thomas Escalante, who owns Sig's Lagoon Record Shop, if he knew a bass player that could fill in for this audition of this a female country singer that they were trying to present. They needed to put a band behind her. So he got the word to me, they're looking for a bass player to do this, you should check it out. Would you be interested? And I said, sure, I'd be interested. I ended up setting up the appointment and went to the audition. And that, you know, went through its audition. We did three songs with her. And then after it was all said and done, I left, you know, and went back about my gigs and my life. 6 months later, I get a call from the same guy, Brad Turcotte. And he asked me, or, you know, here I am leaving a gig. It's 1:30 in the morning or something. And I'm checking my messages. And he says, hey, this is Brad. I haven't talked to you in a while. I have a job for you. I want you to be Billy Joe Shaver's bass player. So I'm just like, oh, that's the greatest news, that I can get hired and get out of town on tour. This is what I've been wanting to do. And this sounds like a full-time thing. So I called him back in the morning and I rode my bicycle to Music World, because I didn't have a car at the time. I rode my bicycle over there, and I couldn't get those gates to open because they usually take the weight of a car before the sensor goes off. So I had to call him. And mind you, at the time, I was working at HCC as a teacher, was bartending in the Continental Club on Wednesdays, selling tacos at Tacos A Go-Go, selling records at Sig's Lagoon, and bartending at the Big Top, all during that time. So on this day off, I went over there and sat in the office with him, and we negotiated what was going to happen. And he told me about what was going on, and I said, well, I'm going to have to quit 5 jobs to join Mr. Shaver, but I really want to. This is something I need to do, so I'm all about it. Oh, and the reason he had thought about me was because Billy Joe had wanted an upright player at the time, and during that audition 6 months later, I thought it was a good idea, because it was an electric bass gig. I thought it was a good idea that I got the upright. So somehow, because I wanted them to see me, that was the instrument I shine on, you know, I felt at least. And I got the singer to talk them into letting me bring it so we could do a song with upright bass. So it turned out to be a good thing, because it got me the gig with Shaver. So here I am I got hired by Shaver, and I get the call, and I have a certain date that I'm supposed to meet in Waco. And I'm thinking there's a bus or there's a van going to pick me up at a parking lot at a truck stop somewhere off I-10 or 290 that can get me to Waco. And as I'm setting all of the arrangements up to get to Billy Joe, I'm thinking somebody's picking me up. Well, I'm calling Brad, and he's like, no, I mean, you got to get up there yourself. You know, you got to go to Waco yourself. And I'm thinking, all right, well, I don't have a vehicle. I need to figure this one out. Well, my sister at the time had ended up, of course, I tell my whole family that I just got hired by, you know, country legend Billy Joe Shaver. And they're really excited for me and kind of going, well, how do you do it? How do you do this? Because this is the first time I'm leaving town, you know, for a while to go play music full time. Well, I'm sitting there and I'm living at the Continental Club at the time. I'm living upstairs from it. Packing up my bass, kind of wondering who's going to give me a ride over there. I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, I really don't, but I'm not going to give up. I'm calling rental car companies about one-way drop-offs and asking friends if they could take me. And well, my sister calls me at one point and she's like, man, Nick, I'm not going to let you lose this opportunity. I'm taking the day off tomorrow and we're going to get in a pickup truck and we're going to drive you to Waco. So here we are. It's 9 or 10 at night. She says, let's drive overnight. That way, because I was due to be in Billy Joe Shaver's at his door at, I think, 8 that morning or something like that. So I'm just like, really, you do that? And she's, of course, I can't let you lose this, man. You know, my sister, she loved what I was, she's always supported what I was doing. So now I'm downstairs at the Continental Club getting their oversized trash bags that they use in those big barrel trash cans. I'm I'm wrapping my bass up, my upright bass in this thing, because we're going in a pickup truck. We're not going in some van or anything that's, and it's raining outside, mind you. I'm wrapping the amp up, I'm wrapping the bass up, I'm doing all that, and then kind of just telling them, all right, send me the address, I'll see you there. What I asked Brad one more time, what do I do? Do I meet him at like the Flying J or the Love's truck stop or something? He's like, no, you go to his house. You go knock on his door. And I was like, wow. Just because I didn't know him, and I was just like, this is a trip. I'm going right to this guy's door. So overnight, my sister and I were going. We go, me, my sister, and her friend. We go through Waco, and we make it to Waco. It's late. We get a room, and I'm going to get up early in the morning tomorrow. And we're going to go meet Billy Joe Shaver. So when they drop me off in the morning, here I am pulling my stuff out, wrapped in plastic. And I go knock on his door, and here comes Billy. There's the man that you've seen in the pictures and the magazines and everything. And all those old pictures with Willie and Waylon and everybody else. And he opens the door, and there's two pit bulls next to him. And he looks at me and kind of cocks his head. His eyebrows kind of furrow a little bit. He goes, oh, that's right. You're the boy from Houston. So there I am at his door. Yes, sir. And yeah, hang on a second. Let me put these dogs up, he says. And he goes and puts the dogs back and lets me in the house. And we sit down. He says hi, but then he's still packing his gear up, because there's a tour bus coming for all of us. And it's just him and I there at the time. Then the band starts showing up, and they all show up in the tour bus. And then this is my first time on a tour bus too. So here I am. I'm getting my stuff out there. And we introduced ourselves briefly. Billy wasn't big on words right away. Of course, he was concentrating on getting all his stuff so he wouldn't forget anything. And as we load up the tour bus, and I meet all these other guys for the first time. You know, his guitar player, his bass player that he just let go, but is still on this tour. So that was weird, but he was a cool guy, and he had a bus driver's license. I don't know which license it is that you do with a bus driver and a tour bus driver. So Billy didn't quite get rid of him, but gave him another job. That's the kind of guy Billy is too. You know, he stays friends with people, and he doesn't. If you're not in his band, you're still his friend somehow. You could work for him some other way. And we get rolling. And as we get rolling towards North Carolina for the first time, it's 2008. There we are. We get on the highway. And after Billy gets himself situated, then he comes out to the common area in the bus and introduces himself, because there's a few new guys in there. There's me. There's a tour manager he had. But then there's this band that he already knows. So that was the first day on tour with him. And out of all the, you know, those memories are distant, but they're still the most recent, because that was the one big, you know, the national gig that I got, and even international. We went to Europe when I was with him, but that was the biggest gig I had to that, you know, to that point in my life. And it was something so different from playing in a local band and playing in, like we call them, my buddy Jeremy always calls them a three-county band, you know. But we were getting out there now, and like, this is it. I don't have another job except music. And, you know, and I have to make jobs when I come back if there's going to be a lot of off time. And that's a whole other side of survival in music, is the other things you got to do.
Segues perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you want to add something?
There's, after Billy, you know, of course, I continued playing with, you know, my band here at town, but then I got hired by Nikki Hill, and that was this year. So that's the most current thing. And that's been 4 months, and I've played tons of shows on four continents with her already. And they're just a really hardworking band. And that band that I play with now, the Nikki Hill band, is about the busiest I've been in all of these years I've been playing. And that's all I was going to say about that.
Let's go back to before you were touring so many continents and had so many dates. What did you do to make a living? And specifically, did you book other events or shows? Did you promote any bands or did you book for any places?
You're talking about things I do for work, like to make it, to pay bills and stuff, or just in general, just
general.
That I do to everything that I do to help other people or do to book other people. Yeah. I've booked, yes, I've done tons of things in between those gig times, those tour runs. I come back from tour after I was done playing with Billy Joe last year in 2016 in the fall. I sought out some other work, like some manual work. I got hired, you know, I would do different odd jobs around, you know, the neighborhood or for friends or stuff on cars for family. But the thing that had the big impact on me most recently was, you know, those times you'll do anything. You get part-time gigs, you go sit in with other bands live, you go do session work. You go to a studio and you get, you know, a per song or per day sort of, you know, deal worked out with somebody who's hiring you for something. Or you trade it for studio time, or you barter it some other way. The thing that I got picked up on recently was becoming a plumber's apprentice with my friend John Graham. He hired me and took me in and gave me a lot of work during the time that I was planning not to be playing a whole lot. So then I'm learning trades that are going to help me in the end anyway. When I, you know, when you buy another house and you have these troubles, you don't really have to go, you save lots of money. But that type of work I've done, and through the years, the work has changed because part-time gigs like library shelving or working at the smoke shop or working at the pawn shop or all these different shops, odd jobs, aquariums, you know, things like that have all come in between different labor jobs, but plumbing, you know, I've booked for bands. I've been their booking guy. I booked for different bars, keep the entertainment going on a weekly basis or however much the bar does. I've done the press listings for different bars. So there's all these angles of music that you can take. It's not just about being on stage. There's merchandising. You can get into that. I haven't done it. Well, I have done that. I've jumped into making buttons at one point. I started a small button business based on that. So booking bands, making buttons, booking the entertainment, being the talent buyer for the bars. For certain ones, you know, that I do promotions for different, you know, different bars too. And these things are all sort of these supplemental incomes that help life, you know, be a little bit easier while you're off the road and you still need money coming in because, you know, if you're not making it, you're spending it. So
tell me more about the places mm-hmm. that you may book bands and which bands you book.
Okay. Well, I book for the D&W Lounge, for example. Still currently, I do that. And some of the bands I book for, I will plug them in there. But then there's, so let's say I pick up the entertainment. I'm a talent buyer for every Friday night at the D&W Lounge at the time. And that's been the last several years. And everybody that comes through there, that plays there, some of those bands I will book for in other places. I've gotten busy these last, you know, few months, but it's something that I'm not doing as much as I was doing when I had the time to be, you know, kicking at it all the time. Now, some of the bands that I've booked for have been my own, any combination that I get hired for. If somebody calls me from downtown and has an event, from the special event, you know, the mayor's office, I get to put anything together. I get to custom make a band for a certain set, depending on what they want. But I also book for a country band, the Broken Spokes, doing honky tonk, rockabilly, and classic country. If gigs come up, I can connect those two people. It doesn't necessarily mean even like if I get a gig for Robert Rodriguez's band Mas Pulpo, because something comes up that just like I could pass on bass work, I could pass on gig work to the next guy too. And that's how I do that. The band I was booking for was the Broken Spokes, and the D&W Lounge I still book for. But I've worked for the Continental Club doing some booking, some show production, and some of the press listings. I've done the same thing for the Big Top. I wanted, there's a few other bands that I can remember getting gigs for, but Broken Spokes were my main one that I sort of booked for and got shows for. And even that was a little while back.
Tell me about some of the kind of all-day sort of festival-type shows that you've done.
Okay. I've done the latest ones that I've done that have been a really big, you know, have had a big impact on me were Byron Bay Blues Fest in Byron Bay, Australia. And that thing is huge. I mean, Carlos Santana was there, Buddy Guy, I want to say. You saw Houston's The Suffers there. I was there with Nikki Hill. I mean, this is like days and days of those all day. I mean, this is like a week-long festival. There are shows like the Cazorla, Blues Cazorla in Spain, which is a blues festival that is it's put on inside a bullring. So that was a really unique experience. I've played Houston International Fest several years while it was still going on. Gigs on college campuses are always fun because that's a crowd that's energetic and interested in, you know, in anything that's happening on campus. It seems to be a cool hit, especially when music is involved. I played the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival with Billy Joe Shaver. And that was the same time that I got to meet like Dave Alvin, Richie Havens, got to see Steve Earle perform, watch the Flatlanders after not playing together for so many years. That was really cool. I played a thing called Ska Wars in Monterrey, Mexico, and that was a long time ago. And that festival's a big event, still going on all these years later. Rock Baby Rocket, which is Edgar Salazar, Big E, owner of Big Cat's Barbershop, he's put that on, that Rockabilly, Houston's only Rockabilly Festival, and that's been going on for 17 years now, I want to say. So that's a handful of those festivals that I've done. Those have been great. And there's so many more. I'm just off the top of my head, those are the ones that are in those snapshots, huge memory.
Kind of bouncing off what you said about Big E and Edgar's Rock Baby Rock. Mm-hmm. You've put together some events like that, haven't you?
I've put together two events so far that I could say were significant enough to mention, and that sort of where I take my angle of interest and influence and plug them in. One is the Old Moon Festival that started about 5 years ago. And I put that on at the D&W Lounge because as a kid, I've always loved the fall season, and the weather gets cooler and the earth goes to sleep a little bit and people's moods change and these different magic things happen. So I always love that celebration of the fall. I've always been a fan of Halloween and that All Hallows season there, you know, before November and into November, early November. So I wanted to throw what would be a fall Halloween and Dia de los Muertos all tied in together sort of party where everything was just celebrated and people just have a good time. And, you know, for fun, for entertainment, but just also just, you know, it's really just a celebration, just a fall celebration. But all of these things are included. So music's a big part of that because that would be the main thing that I could be in control of and could contribute to first. So the Old Moon Fest is where I bring in vendors, musicians, a lot of people from the neighborhood, and we're talking food vendors, art, you know, clothing, vintage, recycled, resold, everything. And then it's a gig inside a bar, but in the parking lot turns to this sort of flea market because I've always loved the pulga and I've always loved hanging out and playing gigs at bars, so I could tie this thing all into one thing during my favorite time of the year. And that's what Old Moon Fest became. The other annual thing that I put together is a Tejas Roots showcase for my Tejano roots that I like to celebrate with a lot of the music that I play and that I take part in, bands that I play with and identify with, usually have they have some roots in Texas music, in Tejano roots, you know, the Mexican-American side of you know, conjunto, rancheras, you know, everything to the modern music that we love. But it was a celebration of that. So, and that's something, and it's about 2 years old now. And now that is not a festival, it's more of a showcase that just, you know, it celebrates our history and celebrates where we're going. And that brings together our community. It brings the classic music in with the newer music. You know, I brought in Manuel Mendiola of the Exiles, a Houston band formed, Tejano band formed in Houston in the 60s. And he has a big history in Chicano soul and early Tejano music, the Pan America nightclub, all of these things that are significant in our own history here. But then I'll bring in a band like Los Nahuatlatos from San Antonio, who are Chicano soul fusion, a band from the 2000s, cats that I know from San Antonio. These fit together. This is what Tejas music is. This is Tejas roots. We're all connected to it. So that's what the Tejas Roots Showcase celebrates, is that diversity, our history, and where we're taking it.
Tell me a little bit more about what it means to you, and also what it means to the community, the people who go to the show.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what it means to me is that I get to showcase and introduce people that to music that this is what young Tejanos are doing. This is what somebody who has had the same roots that you do in Texas, this is what they are doing with the music that has influenced them. So when we bring the old and the young together, people of all ages, it's as diverse as all the colors that our city is. It's the age group. We can be brought together, not based on any number or shade, you know, is what I think. It celebrates that, but we focus on our own region. We focus on our history. And it goes beyond just a one-sided thing. For example, music evolves. Orquestas and conjuntos became Tejano. Tejano picked up influences from other stuff along the way. And now here we are again. I'm, you know, several generations in, you know, Tejano. So then here's where I'm taking it, because I'm influenced by a whole lot of other stuff now. And I happen to be a musician. So I get that control creative control to put those things together and to put them out. That's what it means to me, is that we get to see the ever-evolving soundscape that is Tejas Roots. What it means to the audience is, it could mean, I don't, you know, it could mean anything to them. It could mean coming to a show and hanging out, having a good time. It could mean coming out, meeting lots of people that you end up identifying with that you didn't know were there in the first place. It could mean, wow, this actually happens. I love this. This feels perfect, like home to me. Or it can mean, you know, this is a side of it that I didn't know about. I don't know if I'm crazy about it, but it's there. You know, it's just, it's all about getting to know it, regardless of how we feel about it.
You talked a little bit about how Tejano music was a mix of different genres of Mexican-American music, and later that maybe some other types of music, more mainstream, were thrown in. I'm also thinking, you were saying your band is like that as well. Would you say, and if so, how is it that like bands like Nahualitos?
Yeah, Nahualatos.
Nahualatos?
Yep.
Do they do the same thing, and how do they do that?
They do something similar. They do their own brand of it, I think. And of course, we pull from a common root, as conjunto music is the common ground between us both. But we're all fans of jazz, and lots of us have been in punk rock bands or punk rock type bands that are just do it yourself type, you know, write your own music, don't fit into a genre, write what you feel. It's kind of like we're still doing that, only we just have a little bit more of our own cultural roots plugged into it. That's why the accordion is there. That's why there are congas there. That's why there's a bajo sexto sometimes. But that's also why there's electric guitar, an upright bass, and a steel guitar if we want, you know, so it all works. Yeah, we're doing the same thing, just differently.
If it's okay with you, I think we may move on to DJing, and I kind of see some similarities between what you do with your programming for, Tejas?
Roots, yeah.
Roots, with the Tejas Got Soul.
Yep.
So, if you wouldn't mind taking a short break.
Okay.
Do you have time to talk a little bit about DJing?
Absolutely.
Okay, great, thanks.
All right.
Tell me about Tejas Got Soul.
Tejas Got Soul is something that started with Isaac Rodriguez, who is a big fan and historian of Tejano music and Chicano soul music. And but he's also a big fan in lots of other musical genres, but these are, I think, his main ones. They're definitely, he has a vast knowledge about the subject, and it's really cool. Well, he and I have been friends for a while. We met through the Houston music scene when I was in Los Carnales, and Isaac was in several bands around town. I believe the last one he played with was Fusca. But Isaac and I ran into each other one time. He remembers it all the time. He reminded me. We ran into each other one time on a Tejano music event called Party on the Plaza, running down in downtown on Jones Plaza. And he always reminds me that he's like, you're the only guy I remember seeing out there from the music scene, from the ska and punk and rockabilly scene that I would see at these old school Tejano events. And we laughed about it. And Isaac is big into vinyl, and he started to find a lot of those classic records. And then he ended up DJing as DJ Simmerdown. And he at one point came up with this great name called Tejas Got Soul. And to me, it sounds like something cool, like, it rings into our culture, but it also hints to, like, the rude boy, the Tejano and the rude boy together. Tejas Got Soul, you know, it reminds me of, like, reggae got soul, you know, anything got soul, you know, that you hear. Tejas Got Soul is a celebration of our culture and our music that comes from the barrios everywhere. It comes from our musicians like Rocky Gill, like Little Joe y La Familia, Little Joe and the Latinaires, Sonny Osuna, Sonny and the Sunliners, different record labels around, you know, Texas, Teardrop, Jesna, you know, there's so many. Well, Tejas Got Soul primarily focuses on these genres of classic Tejano, oldies, swamp pop, and early soul. And anything from, I think the way I see it is a lot of stuff from just Texas gets play, but we don't limit it to that. This is one of the things that we do in some of our neighborhood events, or a Tejas Roots event, or the D&W Lounge, our neighborhood bar. And it brings in the community, again, young and old, to celebrate this music that is of us. It is ours. It is of our neighborhood, of our cities, of our culture. And it's two guys or more spinning records. People are dancing, and it's just a bar hangout. So what? Well, it's that, but it's part of our cultural identification, and that draws people out, and that brings our people out in numbers to come celebrate it. And then it works its way into other shows. Like if I put on a showcase with several different great bands that have one foot in Tejas Roots music, well, I feature Isaac Rodriguez DJing to showcase the classic forms of this music that it came from and what it sounded like in the 60s and on. So it sort of, it bridges the gap.
I'm going to ask you some of the same questions I asked you about mm-hmm. the band, about audience interaction mm-hmm. and that type of thing. But describe how the audience interaction influences what you play or whether it does.
That one I could think of in this particular type of context and situation, where if you're playing one song that actually gets people up and dancing, if you're playing a song that lights up the room, then you try to connect it to another one that keeps that electricity going. That's the only way I could think of it. The best interaction is when people are dancing to the music you're playing, whether you're actually playing it on an instrument or spinning it on a record. If it gets the room going, then you're already thinking ahead. What am I going to connect? How do you sort of ride that wave, you know? You catch them dancing, and you try to keep them dancing. And after a while, you shift gears and change the mood. That's the fun part about spinning records like that. You know, and you're playing these things. It's very subjective. You're picking out the stuff, but you also think about what people are going to get down to. they're going to get up and, you know, get up off the table and off their chairs and start dancing because you play a particular song, it's probably a good one and you probably want to do it.
This kind of bounces off of that. Mm-hmm. We've already hit on this a little bit, but tell how the audience responds to the music that you play.
Either by enjoying it, engaging it, and dancing, or they'll come up and ask you, what was that? Or, God, I love that song. Do you really have that on record? And that kind of thing. And one of those, like that, for that second deal where people actually come up and ask you about what you're spinning, that's kind of fun too, because you're meeting somebody else who loves this music. And let's face it, if you're DJing, you're just back there. It's not that hands-on involved that you can't interact with people. So while that song's going, you know, and I'm not talking about this high-tech DJing where you got to be on, like, controlling a rocket ship. I mean, we're spinning records here, a song at a time. So it's kind of cool when people come up and compliment your taste, or they say, I have a whole collection of that, and you start talking music. And again, it's musicians or music lovers just nerding out with each other and just totally geeking out on something that they both think is cool.
Do people ever come up to you and tell you stories about, you know, how they know that song, or where they first heard that song, or why
yes.
that song is meaningful to them?
Yes, there's been people that have come up that say, I love that song so much because I used to go see them live at the Pan America Ballroom. You have the people that come up and say, you know, my uncle owns that record label, or my, you know, this guy I went to this church with owned that record label that, you know, that band was on. Or you have the ones that come up and say, I used to know that guy, and they used to call him this, or they had this nickname for him, and he lived over here on this street in Second Ward, because a lot of the stuff we play is local. Local meaning either Houston or just Texas. So we have, you know, those roots are still very strong there. So you can meet somebody who's the nephew, the neighbor, the friend of a, you know, somebody who's on one of those records, and it's really a trip. Even my barber on Capitol and over here in Magnolia, he's telling me the other day that he finds his brother-in-law's name in a song credit for an Exiles record, and it's that kind of small world stuff. Like, and that's one of the thrills to find out. That's like history gold, local history gold right there.
What do you think it means to somebody in the audience who remembers those songs from when they were new songs, to hear them now?
I can identify with that mostly to where I would hear my parents identify with music or different songs that come together. Give you an example. Like driving down Lawndale with my father, we're going to pay bills or go to the grocery store, or going to go buy charcoal because we're going to barbecue. An oldies song comes on, and he's beating on the steering wheel to the rhythm and singing everything like he's just loving it. And he would often say, oh man, that song right there, I was in sixth grade when that came out. And oh man, we were just fixing to go to school. It was already, you know, September was coming around, the school year was going to start, and I was just, you know, wondering, you know, which girl I was going to fall in love with that year or something like that. So it, because music takes us to a time and a place, you know. Songs, or I mean a commercial, anything that's music, just sneaks into our hearts and minds and our souls. It gets in there. So when I think of that, when I think of my dad reacting that way to songs himself, that's the same way I feel. If I hear like a tune that was big in the 90s, it takes me back to high school now, you know. Once we've lived enough years, I think that we know the time and place that music takes us to, you know. It triggers some memory. My mom, same thing. Certain music reminds me of being a kid around, you know, around the house whenever she was raising us, taking care of us. The nightly news, like, theme song makes me think of being at home, and both my parents are home from work, and we're just the family settling in for the evening, you know. But now at a show, if we're spinning records and we're getting people into it, it means the same things for them. What music means for us individually, like we have all of these experiences with music, it means the same thing for the people. And whether they they vocalize it, or they just, you know, it just makes them want to dance, or it reminds them of a time. I think music just brings feelings. It just makes feelings happen. All of them. It's like listening to Ray Price. I don't know if I'm happy, sad, or, you know, I mean, I have like all these emotions going through, but it's just what it is.
On the other hand, have you heard much from people who are younger and maybe never heard any of this music before?
If they're, most of the time, younger people, if they hadn't heard it or if they weren't that familiar with it, they will say something to the effect of, oh, that's my dad's music. He loves that stuff. Oh, this is my grandfather's music. He loves Trio Los Panchos. Oh man, my mom loves Vicente Fernandez. Or man, my mom used to dance to Sonny Osuna, you know, with my dad, you know. My case, I hear music like that, I'm like, wow, this is the kind of stuff. When I hear early Tejano, I'm like, this is what my parents met to and were dancing to. You know, Talk to Me, Sonny Osuna, you know, all of these different songs, you know, Smile Now, Cry Later. Like, these were the records my mom would collect as a teenage girl. So what it means to me is like, wow, this is cool. This is our history, and this is where a new generation. So when I hear young people getting hip to older music, it's the same experience I had the first time I heard, you know, anything that I really liked that was from before my time. It's the thing that made me, you know, you think at some point, oh man, it would have been really cool if I was born in, you know, X, Y, or Z decade, because you like the music so much from that. You think you could have, like, lived that, you know. I don't think I would have wanted to be born any other time. But, I mean, I do like, you know, the good thing about music is it is forever as long as there's media to put it on. I mean, we're going to have these recordings forever. So anybody can always identify with it, you know, enjoy them at least. I love Bessie Smith. You know, I'm a huge Bessie Smith fan for the longest time now. And could I identify with that time, place, or anything? No, but as a musician, I love what I'm hearing and love that root sound. And yeah, I could identify with the emotions that are there, but the life that she lived as a person? No, I mean, I don't know. That was a different time. You listen to, the world changes constantly. Music changes, but there's always this common thread or common vibe through it all, I think, that makes us able to understand music from a different time.
A quick question. I believe that I remember you saying that your parents met at the Pan American Ballroom.
Yeah.
Is that true?
It is. My parents met, they were teenagers, and my parents met at the Pan America Ballroom. They would go to shows, different shows there, and I heard there were shows all the time. So I don't know if the teenagers went to a matinee show or something like that type of deal. But you could talk to so many people that live here in Houston that remember that place, that's where they hung out. And Papa Burger, that's still there across the street, was there the whole time. That's where they would go get a burger. But then you hear different sides of that. You know, everybody, like, I've heard people call it, like, to me, if it's the place my parents met, I'm thinking, oh, wow, that's cool. They met as teenagers. And I can only imagine, you put into context what your imagination lets you based on you met people at bars or shows before. So it's like you think, okay, probably the same thing. But you also hear like a dark side of that place where you heard there was a lot of fights. You heard there was a lot of rough stuff going on. But it's funny because I can't imagine. But these, then again, my parents were kids when they met. So who knows what was going on, you know, in the 60s. And that was before, you know, before my dad went off to Vietnam. So my parents were dating. They were both from the East End, Houston. My dad grew up in Clayton Homes. My mom grew up right there on Jensen Drive behind Our Lady of Guadalupe. And Pan America was North Main. So they would go over there. I think my grandmother would take her daughters out to the matinees, take them out to those events. I wish those types of places were still around. But I guess, you know, musical culture and shows have changed since then. The whole nature of a show. You go to a show now, if it's not some festival, you go during the day, you go at the nighttime, you know. But yeah, I wish that type of place was around. That's where my folks met. That's where they got to be friends and started dating. I think a lot of people got, you know, they met there. I know Isaac's, my buddy Isaac's family, I don't know if they got married there or renewed vows or something like that, but there was some sort of deal that's similar. And of course, that's a big part of history of a lot of this larger group's friends, you know, that they have some sort of memory or family memory of the Pan America Ballroom.
I'm gonna shift gears.
Pan America Nightclub, not ballroom.
I'm gonna shift gears a little bit.
Okay.
And you've mentioned the Roots sound or Roots music, mm-hmm. and I want to know what that means to you.
Okay. That one I can answer in just several genres that I find that I, you know, that are the roots. There's blues, there's Tejano, there's jazz, there's rock and roll, and there's the country, of course. All of those can make up anything of what I'm doing, I believe. Those genres right there can all be. The songwriting is a lot, it's very similar to each other in different ways. There's so many common areas in the songwriting structure and the themes, but they all fit. And to me, that's the roots music. That's the music that people were playing 50 plus years ago, 60 plus now. I mean, it's many decades, but that is what has formed rock and roll, that has formed other genres. I mean, that's what started it all for me. That's what I think. When I consider it roots, American roots music is what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. And going back to Tejas Got Soul, mm-hmm. Can you describe some of the venues you play at?
Tejas Got Soul is really an operation that's been used in neighborhood bars or like sort of nightclubs like the Continental Club. Those type of situations. Bars like live music venues or smaller neighborhood bars. That's it can go anywhere, but that's where it was formed out of.
And how do you guys get your gigs?
The same way I do when I book bands. I just, you know, either get the call or make the call. And that's just depending on the nature of a show. If you see yourself a fit and maybe that client isn't aware of you yet, then you make yourself aware. If you get the call, well, they knew what they were doing. They want you in there because they want you to be part of that. Vibe that the room is setting, you know, that's what it is.
What would you say about performing with your act or DJing that we haven't already covered in this interview?
It's our culture, it's our history, but it's also a job that we have to keep interesting. So we have to plug ourselves in wisely to keep ourselves employed and relevant. To us, it's relevant because it's ours. How does it fit in the bigger picture? You have to start locally, like we did. You have to expand, like we did. We end up on, you try to get on big TV stations or shows or big events that make you more visible. But then you have to sustain. You have to sell the records. You have to, you know, write those songs and keep them alive. Because we can be, you know, covering people's music until, you know, you can do that and do that and do that all day long, but until I come out with something original, I'm just kind of putting out what's already been out. So it's our responsibility to take it to the next step, and this is a wide open door because no one says what can and what can't. That threshold is not dictated by anybody, and each individual is their own mind. So my band, or the musicians that I work with, I should say, because there's almost like no official band so much as there is just like this gang that plays music. And that's what we all get each other work. It's like this union, this unspoken union between a circle of musicians that looks out for each other. Everybody's independent, but when they see that they can offer a little bit of money this way or that way, or I could use your services and get you paid, then we do it. We hook each other up. So it's a matter of the guys I play with becoming more than just musicians. It ends up circling around music and entertainment and events, but it's again just to stay plugged in, to stay relevant, and to keep playing and putting out original stuff is what takes us to the next step, or else, you know, we're just cover bands, and we don't want to be cover bands, only cover bands, you know. Those guys get lots of work too, but that's just not what I do.
Anything else you would like to add?
I think I'm good.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your time today.
Absolutely.
I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you, me too.
This concludes the interview with Nick Gaetan. Thank you.
Thank you.